mushrooming JEA scandal is now in the sights of federal prosecutors. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this hour, we speak with City Councilman Ron Salem as the feds begin looking into JEA. What are your thoughts? Join us. The number to call the show is 549-2937. Then later, this month's First Coast Connect book club pick. Plus, we'll tell you what's going on at the Leitner Museum in St. Augustine this winter. All of that coming up. But first this hour, the feds are stepping in to investigate the JEA mess. State Attorney Melissa Nelson says her office has referred the scandal over the failed attempt to privatize JEA to federal investigators. That's the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Middle District of Florida. Jacksonville City Councilman Ron Salem organized a meeting, a public hearing into the JEA scandal some time ago, and he's here now with thoughts on the latest news and some other important bits of information we'll share in a few minutes. Councilman Salem, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa, for having me.
What are your thoughts about the feds now investigating the failed attempt to privatize JEA? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax or weigh in on Facebook. Councilman Salem, you and your colleague Rory Diamond organized a public meeting on the JEA scandal before CEO Aaron Zahn was fired. You held his feet to the fire. The other executives took a grilling. So what's your reaction this morning to this news now that the feds are being brought in to investigate JEA?
Melissa, I came away from that hearing that Councilman Diamond and I conducted believing that there were inappropriate activities within the JEA. Didn't start that hearing thinking that, but at the end of it, I surely did. And as a citizen, as a city councilman, I just want the truth. I want if people have done inappropriate activities, they should be punished. Mm-hmm. And as a citizen, particularly my particular interest is predominantly around the long-term incentive plan where my questioning predominantly occurred. And I just have very strong feelings on the way that plan was set up, who was going to benefit, the dollars that were involved. It's just terrible.
This was a failed scheme to award hefty bonuses to, in particular, the highest paid JEA executives in the event of a sale. And under scrutiny, that plan fell apart, in part due to your efforts. Does that rise, though, to illegal activity, or is it just a shady business practice that didn't have a good look?
Well, let me make one point. That plan was lucrative even without a sale of the JEA, and that sometimes gets lost in this process. A $10 investment in that plan could have been worth around $170 even without recapitalization. So I do want to make that comment. Melissa, I'm not an attorney. As you know, I'm a pharmacist. I'll let the lawyers work this out, but I truly believe that something went awry at the JEA, and this plan was clearly inappropriate for a public utility.
It's 549-2937 to connect with Councilman Ron Salem. On Monday, the interim CEO of the company, Melissa Dykes, announced she will not seek the permanent post. At the same time, the former CEO, Aaron Zahn, we're still waiting to find out if he's going to receive a so-called golden parachute, a payout from the company, or whether he'll be terminated with cause. What do you think should happen there?
Well, I believe he should be terminated with cause. I've said that all along. The Office of General Counsel is going through a number of interviews with board members, employees of the JEA, accumulating information, which it is my hope that will lead to his termination with cause. I feel strongly about that, and I even appeared in front of the JEA board mm-hmm. and said, even if there's some type of arbitration where he fights it, that would be money well spent by the citizens in order to deprive him of any benefits.
Now, let me ask you as well your reaction to how this could potentially affect the Curry administration. State Attorney Nelson had faced a lot of pressure to investigate or recuse herself from an investigation because she has ties to two political consultants who are also tied to the mayor. One of them is his chief administrative officer. Published reports have shown that operatives with ties to the mayor were closely involved in the JEA privatization push, perhaps even speaking inappropriately to Florida Power and Light executives during the so-called cone of silence period. The mayor has also faced criticism for purging the JEA board during his first term and installing what critics say were cronies or favorites of his that would enact his agenda to privatize JEA. So my question is, if the federal grand jury leads to the mayor's office in some form or fashion, what would be your reaction?
Wherever it leads, Melissa, is where it needs to go. I mean, we need to get to the truth of this. And I'll leave it at that. I believe there were a lot of inappropriate activities within the JEA, as I stated, particularly around the beginning of this plan and how these contracts were released right after the board meeting the very next day and throughout that performance unit plan process. And we need to get to the bottom of it. The mayor has said he will cooperate with any questions or any requests, and I think that's the right approach.
Now, you're relatively new to public office. That said, what's your reaction to critics of the Jacksonville City Council, who in the past felt that the council didn't exercise enough oversight into these board appointments and into the elevation of Aaron Zahn as JEA CEO?
Well, I can just tell you, I've been on the city council for 6 months, and I'm extremely proud of my colleagues and the efforts that we have undertaken. Hearing that Councilman Diamond and I conducted, we read 2,000 pages of documents over a four-day period and prepared questions for a hearing. And I think it was the council that sort of led this effort, frankly. It was Kyle Billy who brought the dollars associated with that performance unit plan to the TEU committee November 18th, which I think was the day that I used that comment, mind-boggling, that the media picked up, that really, I believe, started the whole process of unraveling this whole privatization effort.
In a moment, we'll speak about something you're doing with the mayor today, actually, a news conference about a city partnership with Daly's to raise awareness about underage vaping. That's coming up in a few moments. But first, what are your questions for City Councilman-at-Large Ron Salem as we learn that the federal prosecutors are now looking into the JEA scandal? That's the failed attempt to privatize the publicly owned city utility. Let's go to your calls. It's 549-2937. Let's start with Cynthia in Ortega River. Cynthia, hi. I know you're in the queue. Now you're on the air. Cynthia, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was just saying, I'm so glad interviewing has said that I've all along felt that where you smell a rat, there's a rat hole, and there's a whole lot more to this than we even know at this point in time, and I'm so glad that it's going to be investigated.
Thanks for that. You typically hear that from voters, councilmen. The majority of voters want more information, wouldn't you say?
To Cynthia and the listeners, there are still a number of questions that I have about the performance unit plan and other questions. So, and I know my colleagues on the city council feel the same way. So whatever entity, whether it's the state attorney or the feds that are needed to get to the bottom of this, hopefully thoroughly and quickly, so that we can move on from this scandal, a potential scandal, I'm all for it.
Now, there are differences in the way a federal grand jury might operate as opposed to a state grand jury. They're both secret, but at the same time, if someone is called to testify before a federal grand jury, they would not have the same immunity from prosecution that they might have if State Attorney Melissa Nelson's office called them to testify. So there is certainly, the stakes are higher now, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. The the people that I've spoken to this last evening once I received the news indicates that this truly escalates the process, that the federal grand jury does not have to provide as much immunity to witnesses, that and that will hopefully enable them to get more information. So clearly mm-hmm. The feds would not be getting engaged unless they felt like maybe there were federal crimes that occurred that are more appropriate on a federal level.
549-2937. Julie is in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Julie. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. Hi, let me turn off my radio here. Sorry.
Yeah, sure.
My question is, does the councilman see any issues with our system of, well, the council address the charter system? It seems like the way we have the city set up, it was kind of ripe for something like this to happen, allowing the mayor to have so much power and things like that. Will the city council address that?
Yeah. Thanks, Julie. Thank we're getting comments on Facebook about that, pointing out that the Charter Revision Commission is meeting right now. They're even looking at creating a new authority, says John on our Facebook page. Does the city need to change its charter in the wake of all this?
Julie, that's a great question. And I think my colleagues and I are interested in some charter changes. Councilman Dennis had a public notice meeting about changing some of the appointments to the JEA board. And I think the consensus amongst the council presently is to let this process move forward a little bit. And then mm-hmm. let's address what might be several charter changes around the JEA in terms of appointments, who appoints them, staggered terms, whether the mayor can cut those terms short. There are a lot of ways that you could structure that board.
Not just that board, but other boards and commissions too, right?
Absolutely. I have been a real advocate as we've gone through this process is to make sure the board members of what I call the big four authorities, to make sure they're engaged in the business of those entities, to make sure something like this never happens again.
549-2937. Cheryl in Arlington is with us. Hello, Cheryl.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, Melissa.
Sure.
I love your show.
Thank you.
Anyway, I have a comment to make on the very bottom line. It's the one reason we are stuck with this mayor and his cronies is because there was such a low voter turnout during the election. And this coming election is so important. We've got to get out there and vote. Friends and neighbors, you need to help your neighbors that can't go. Sign up and take them to the poll. It's so important that we all, that's our legal remedy as a citizen, is our vote, and your vote counts when you think that there might be, what was it, Al Gore lost Florida by 6,000 votes? That's a neighborhood. That's a subdivision.
It was a few hundred votes, actually, Cheryl. Yeah, I mean,
well,
ultimately.
And that's a couple of streets in a subdivision. So votes count.
Thanks, Cheryl. You know, it's interesting, Councilman, the next mayoral election and the next city council election, I think we will see more engagement in the wake of this whole scandal, because it's one of the rare scandals that could really arouse a large voting bloc. You know, we didn't see high turnout in the last election. I don't think that'll be the case next time.
Well, sure. Cheryl, I started my campaign 3 years early. I went all over this community for months meeting with residents and trying to get my message out. And I waited till this point in my life to run because I wanted to be able to devote more time to the council. So I believe we've got some very, very sharp people on the council. I think this is one of the better councils that we've had, frankly, when you look at the total 19 of us. And I welcome as much engagement as we can. I think the more people that are engaged, the better council that you're going to have.
We'll go back to your calls in a moment. For City Councilman Ron Salem, the number to join us is 549-2937. A few other matters to discuss making news this week, but first, let's get to some of your comments on social media and email. Marina emails the show. We should all be thankful the local news media kept up on this. We would have been clueless otherwise. JEA would have been sold, our politicians and their cronies would have been happy, and we would have been stuck with a lot of debt and raised rates. Marina, thank you for that. Here is an email for you from Joe. He has two questions for you, Councilman. Number one, do you believe the JEA scandal is tied to the mayor's office? And number two, how much responsibility does the JEA board have over this scandal, specifically board chair April Green and board member Kelly Flanagan?
I have seen no evidence to tie this to the mayor's office, and I'm one that likes to deal with facts. Number two, board members, clearly, if you speak to the board members, particularly those that were at the infamous July 23rd board meeting where, for example, this performance unit plan was passed by the board in a unanimous vote, they will tell you they were unaware of the implications of that plan and were, I think, personally misled to the cost of that plan. And which has been one of the things I have been advocating is we've got to make sure board members are thoroughly engaged in all decisions and are asking questions if they're not clear on a particular issue.
You say you've seen no evidence. That said, there's certainly a narrative that has emerged that at the very least, the board members were executing an agenda they thought Mayor Curry wanted.
Well, I can't read people's minds, Melissa. I just know, particularly on the PUP, it was the last item on the agenda that day, July 23rd. They spent about 10 or 15 minutes on a plan that could have cost the taxpayers up to $1 billion. If the JEA would have been sold with a net amount of somewhere around $7 to $9 billion.
Jay tweets the show, is it illegal for a board of directors and CEO to operate in bad faith? Once it was clear that the community, the owners of JEA, didn't want a sale, the board kept going down that road, ultimately wasting $10 million. That seems out of line. That, I think, has outraged the taxpayers the most. The performance plan never got enacted, Councilman, but the utility did spend some $10 million exploring a sale, hiring lawyers, consultants, traveling to Atlanta to talk to bidders. They did that out of the prying eyes of the local media. And so what about that lost $10 million?
I mean, Melissa, I'm outraged over the $10 million. When that was announced at the board meeting, I was there, and I think it actually is going to be more than $10 million when it's all said and done. It's tragic that we spent those kind of dollars on a plan that was never vetted by the community initially. That whole issue should have gone to the community first to obtain buy-in before it ever got out to the, before it ever went to the board.
Let's go to Jessica on the South Side. Hi, Jessica. What are your thoughts about all this?
Hi. I would like to maybe take a cynical view when I ask this question, but is shifting the investigation to federal authority is just a way for Melissa Nelson to kind of wash her hands of whether any fault might be laid at the mayor's feet when the mayor is such a vocal proponent of the Trump administration? I just don't trust that a federal investigation under Trump would really bring objective justice to a friend of Trump as our mayor.
Okay, thanks for that question.
Well, I know the feds have been involved in a couple investigations here locally. They were involved in the Corrine Brown investigation, and they were involved in the Brown investigation for the two city council members and obtained pretty strong convictions. So I think the feds have shown on a local level that they've been very thorough in their investigations.
And certainly federal investigators have that reputation. That said, one of President Trump's first acts when he was elected was to purge all of the U.S. attorneys in America. He fired the former U.S. attorney in this district, Lee Bentley. Not only did he fire Bentley, he fired all of them, beginning with Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. That district is actively investigating the president, his children, and his defunct foundation in New York, the Trump Organization. And so, you know, one would hope political considerations wouldn't befall an important local investigation like this. But that's the backstory, I think, why some voters are cynical about how this might be conducted.
Melissa, I have much more faith in the federal process than maybe some of your listeners. I really believe that they will move quickly and thoroughly to wrap this up. That's my hope.
Let's go to Jim in Riverside. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi. Councilman, one of the discussions has been around whether or not Melissa Nelson's political...
There's a lot of Melissas floating around. That was a popular name in the late 60s, as we are learning, Jim. So there's Melissa Nelson, Melissa Dykes, me, and who knows who else. But go ahead.
Thank you. Whether Melissa Nelson's campaign consultants had a connection with Mayor Curry. I remember when the campaign was on for city council, your advertisements looked like carbon copies of the mayor's advertisements, right down to the bridge logo. So I'm just wondering, do you share any campaign connections with the mayor?
Thanks for that. Ron Salem.
Yes, Tim Baker ran my campaign.
And we learned in recent days he's the campaign consultant with close ties to the mayor, that he was sitting in on some of these JEA privatization meetings, critics say improperly. So thank you for disclosing that.
Well, I'm very proud of the campaign we ran. It was a very positive campaign. My opponent contacted me afterwards and thanked me for the type of campaign we ran. We got 57% of the vote. And it was a marvelous campaign. The literature, the commercials were, I'm told, were outstanding in terms of their response.
As a follow-up, what's your reaction to critics of the circle around this mayor? These are ruthless, successful campaign operatives. They know how to run and win campaigns. They sometimes run scorched earth campaigns. Are these the most appropriate people, though, to be in city governance?
I think that's up to the... I was very pleased with their campaign, and I may be in another campaign, and I'll deal with that at that time. I think every chief executive ought to surround himself with the people that he desires, whoever they are. Those are his choices.
Given where we are, was that a wise move for this mayor?
Well, I wrote a letter to the mayor this week indicating my experience with Brian Hughes, for example. And my experience with Brian Hughes has been extremely positive. He has been very responsive to me. I've had several individual meetings with him. He was very supportive of the vaping effort that hopefully we'll talk about today.
Let's do that now, because I want to make sure there's enough time given to this. Now, the City of Jacksonville, in partnership with Daly's, today is announcing the launch of an underage vaping public awareness campaign to educate middle schoolers and high schoolers about just how dangerous vaping is. You'll be at this press conference this afternoon at 3 o'clock at City Hall with the mayor. Why is the city embracing this now?
Well, soon after my election, the vaping issue, I think, was at a crisis mode, and I think it still is. And I asked President Wilson to add it to our opioid task force process so that we could get council people engaged and have discussions on it on a regular basis. Through that process, I looked at a number of ways to try to help the situation, one of which was to raise the age to 21, and that has occurred on a federal level. And as I think most of your listeners are aware, the cartridges that teenagers now use are being banned as well, except for a couple different flavors. So It appeared to me the best approach was an educational effort, and we have obtained $100,000 through the generosity of Aubrey Edge of Daly's Place. I'm going to introduce legislation to match that, and we're going to ask the private sector through an RFP to design a program plan that will be the most effective way we can to educate parents and teenagers on the horrors of vaping.
An estimated 25% of high school seniors have vaped nicotine in the past month. Vaping is more popular than alcohol, marijuana, or cigarettes among teens. Very alarming. The rate of teens using e-cigarettes has more than doubled in the last couple of years, in part because they think it's not harmful. So we need to educate them that it is harmful, right?
I think we need to educate them and the parents. I don't think the parents understand that using nicotine at this particular age could have some long-term effects on their children. So if adults want to vape, that's not my issue here. I'm trying to get those 12 to 18-year-olds aware of the potential problems they may have down the road with vaping.
Here are some statistics we pulled from the Duval County Health Department. The highest rates of vaping are reported within Health Zone 1. That stretches from downtown to the northwest side and includes Rebalt, Raines, and Stanton High. Duval's numbers are actually lower than other counties. 12% of Duval teens say they vaped, 15.9% in Clay, 20% in St. John's County. So this is a big problem. And it's so will you work in this campaign? You'll work with schools as well, I'm sure.
Absolutely. We've contacted the Duval County school system. I think you'll find several board members will be at the press conference. I hope the superintendent's able to make it because clearly our efforts are towards the public school students.
There's no regulation of this product. These are developing brains and bodies that teens are you know, they're putting this product into their brain and into their body. So it's a big issue. Now, you said you wanted to fold this, councilman, into the opioid effort on the city council. Can you bring us up to date on what's happening there?
On the opioid specifically?
Yeah.
We are meeting, interestingly, Thursday at 2 o'clock at City Hall. We continue to approach through that program people that have come into the ER, and there's four or five emergency rooms that are in our program. Someone that's overdosed on opioids, received Narcan, which is the drug that reverses it, and they're given an opportunity to get into treatment immediately.
Mm-hmm.
They can sign up while they're in the ER, and roughly 50% of those patients do that. And then we monitor them and try to make sure that they don't do that again, basically.
And this was a pilot program the city decided to fund a year or two ago.
That is correct. Almost 2 years ago now.
To the tune of how many million dollars?
It's about $1 million
a
year.
And do you see any potential of expanding that, given how serious this health crisis is?
Well, we are about to enter into UF Health's emergency room. We are trying to get into every available emergency room here locally that we can. It just takes time and effort, and contractually, it's a lot of work that needs to be done.
So you're saying about 50% of the people who have overdosed and almost died from opioid abuse agree to go into treatment.
That is correct.
About 50%.
Through this program.
Through this city program. And at the same time, the city of Jackson a while back joined a lot of other cities in suing the pharmaceutical giants over the incredible human cost of this crisis. Where does that lawsuit stand?
We're in the middle of that. My impression is this is going to be a several-year process. This is not we're not going to see any money from this for quite some time. That's what the attorneys tell me.
But potentially the city could reap a windfall of millions for how much it costs Jacksonville,
right,
to treat people who are literally dying on the streets, dying in the morgue. The former medical examiner for Duval once said on this program, they literally cannot keep up with the, this is gruesome to say, but the dead bodies that they are having to deal with as people overdose on opioids.
Yeah, prior to coming on the council, I was on the board of pharmacy through my profession during the height of this crisis. So there are multiple people to blame for this crisis. There were bad physicians, there were bad pharmacists, the wholesalers were shipping drugs without really checking on orders. Physicians were prescribing them inappropriately. There are multiple people to blame for where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all part of the lawsuit, clearly.
That's right. Well, we'll continue to follow it. And again, today at 3 o'clock at City Hall, Councilman Salem will join the mayor and president of Daly's Place, Aubrey Edge, to announce a new partnership and campaign to combat underage vaping in this city. So lots of news we covered this morning. Councilman Ron Salem, we thank you for going through it with us. We'll see you soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
And up next, a tale that speaks to greed and economic boom and bust cycles. Our book club examines Black Tulip by Alexandre Dumas. That's next. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson.
Together, we host the Florida Roundup, a weekly live statewide call-in show looking at the biggest issues impacting the Sunshine State. If it's making news in Florida, you'll hear it on the Florida Roundup. So join us each Friday at noon, right here on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT and the Florida Theater present Canadian acoustic guitarist, composer, and producer Jesse Cook, performing live at the WJCT Soundstage on Tuesday, January 21st, 2020, at 8 p.m. Jesse Cook blends rumba, flamenco, and elements of new age and jazz to create his uniquely global sound. Don't miss the opportunity to see Jesse Cook live at the WJCT Soundstage. Visit wjct.org/events for more information.
Hey, what's jazzin'? I'm Damian Lamar. Join me for Taste Tests and broaden your musical palate as we redefine urban radio. Have a taste. Saturdays and Tuesdays at 11 p.m. on WJCT 89.9 FM, Jacksonville.
This book club segment is underwritten by San Marco Books and More.
Welcome back. It's a tale that speaks to greed, economic boom and bust cycles, and more. A tale as timeless as today. Stacey Goldring is here now with this month's First Coast Connect Book Club pick, Black Tulip by Alexander Dumas. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great. So this book is wonderful if you like The Three Musketeers or The Count of Monte Cristo. He wrote those two.
He did. And if you think those are kind of difficult to tackle because they weigh about 50 pounds apiece, this is the perfect Alexander Dumas to start with because it's a very small book. It's his last really successful novel, and it speaks to today. It's really remarkable how relevant it is, even though it's a story that takes place in the 1630s. It focuses around the idea of tulip mania, which was basically the first like economic boom and bust. So that it takes place during a raging market.
People all over the world wanted to buy tulips from Holland.
Yeah, they were very exotic. And they actually came from, I believe it's from Morocco or Turkey. But anyway, that speaks to the Dutch East India Company. But it starts off with this gruesome mob murder where these two people are literally, is the word disemboweled? I mean, they are, I mean, you could chop them up and sell them at Publix. It is so horrible.
Oh, man.
But, and it's based on a true story where these political brothers, the DeWitt brothers, were accused of plotting against William of Orange. So if you ever wonder why in the Olympics in the Netherlands always wear orange, it's because it's the House of Orange. But from there, it blossoms into a love story. And it's also about the greed and the love of botany and it's kind of a rivalry between this one man who simply wants to grow the perfect black tulip and this man whose name is Boxall, who is just driven by greed, and he wants to also create the first black tulip. And there's this huge reward in the country for whoever comes up with it first. So it's the idea that who's going to get there first. And of course, there is a love interest, and her name is Rosa, which is just so beautiful. But with this story, you get the full package because it's historical. There's romance. There's gore. There's suspense. And what's interesting, and
could be a good movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually it was. It was also a cartoon, but don't get me started. But if you want to hear more about this particular book, I'll be speaking with Cindy Edelman at Literature on February 12th at noon at the Kummer Museum. And you can go online and just Google Literature, Kummer, and Love Letters. And we'll be speaking about the Black Tulip and some beautiful artwork at the Kummer that also speaks to the Black Tulip.
Very nice. So this is a chance for people to meet you in person.
Right. And learn more about this amazing book because I've just, just touched on it.
And Dumas, his literary contribution is
amazing.
Everyone's heard of The Three Musketeers.
Oh my gosh, and The Count of Monte Cristo is one of my all-time favorite stories, and let me just say, never would have read it if it weren't for a book club.
Yes, and being in a book club is the greatest thing going, because not only do you get to read a great book every month, you make some cool friends, and it's social. And now Stacy does the virtual book club every month on our air, but She also, as we've have learned through the years, does physical book clubs.
That's
more
right.
than one.
That's right. That's right.
She's a busy lady. She does a book club at her underwriter, San Marco Books and More. She has another book club that's mm-hmm. in another part of town.
I've got them all over. You can't escape me. So if you want to talk about books, you can certainly find it. And it is a great way to make friends. And on January 29th, we've actually changed the date at San Marco Books and More, 6:30. We will be discussing another book about, the Dumas book is also about revenge. And this book also is about revenge, and it has the best title. It's called Autopsy of a Boring Wife.
Oh, I am intrigued right off the bat.
Oh, right? I mean, that's so great. And it's a beautiful cover because the person is wearing a cardigan and pearls, so that totally speaks to me. And this is a story as if Nora Ephron, you remember Heartburn? You remember
it? Of course. Yeah.
So it's the, this is translated from the French, and it's almost like the translator was like channeling Joan Rivers. So it's this amazing book of this woman who the husband walks out on her because she's boring. And so it follows those tropes of, it's a younger woman, blah, blah, blah. And what we really get from the story, I think the translation is really what must make this book, is that, when the furniture goes flying out the window, you get it. And when the lawn doesn't get mowed for months on end, you sympathize. And, maybe we're not going to wear shoes today because, we're grieving. 30 plus years of marriage. He walks out for this little pixie. Not happy. Not happy. So this is a book that speaks to friendship, therapists, mm-hmm. the supporting family. And it's also about what I call that 2.0. We all have to start over. We all have chapters and we have to turn the page. And this book speaks to the power of that.
And it's translated from French, but it's certainly a universal theme.
Oh, this one's going to be so fun to talk about. I can't wait. It is laugh out loud. Heartbreaking, but laugh out loud.
Okay, so now that's coming up at San Marco Books and More.
Right, and that's January 29th. We had to switch the date because we're busy people.
Yes. So let's talk about
January
the fact,
29th,
too, that now the bookstore, which is such a great place, go visit and support your independent bookseller in your neighborhood. San Marco Books and More is such a treasure on the First Coast. There was a fire a while back at a business there in the square that temporarily closed San Marco Books and More, but they've fixed that, haven't they?
They did, and the community was incredibly supportive for all the merchants, and it was so wonderful because all the books had to be cleaned that could be salvaged, every one. They had to be taken off the shelves. They had to be reshelved, and people were so happy when they saw that the bookstore was reopened. It opened on Black Friday. Mm-hmm. Because books bring people together. Books are a universal language. And we need these we need these points of intersection regardless of our background. And that's what bookstores and books offered. And people were coming in and hugging the owner saying, "We're just so glad you're back."
That's great. Now, were they able to save all of the books?
Not all of them, but a lot of them.
Most of them. That's good. Now, in this era of people just constantly reading and scrolling on their phones, books remain just as popular as ever, don't they?
They do, and people have become like connoisseurs of what type of reading style. Some people, like, I don't know if you've ever done this, I'll be reading a book and all of a sudden I'll press the page, like, I don't know that word, like I'm pressing on the word because I want to look it up. Like, because I'm used to being on my iPad or and I can look it up. So people prefer, the purists, they want to read the book. They want to feel those pages. They want to, have that tactile experience. They want to be able to avoid people in the airport. It used to be the thicker, the better. Like I would travel with Atlas Shrugged. Don't bother me. But, and there's other people, you can have thousands of books at your fingertips if you're going on a long trip. How incredible to and I've done that one Carl Hyacinth after another. I'm the crazy lady laughing in row 12F because I'm just having the best time reading these books. And
that for me is the best thing about getting on a plane. Oh, I finally have an opportunity to sit and read something I haven't had time to read. Now, let me ask you one more question as our book expert. Do you think physical paper books will ever disappear?
No, and let me tell you why. Because we are a culture of custom. Okay. And what I mean by custom is custom made. So I have read articles about how in the future you can go into a bookstore, pick your title, pick your font, pick your cover, pick the page. You know, do you want it the rough edges, the smooth edges? And you can, you remember how you used to be able to make like those wax things? You know, you could pick Donald Duck or Mickey and it would come out, the little sculpture at the end. You're basically going to be create your book.
Your own designer book.
Yeah, in situ. So that's going to happen. But I don't like to predict things, but I just feel deeply in my heart emotionally, books will never go away. The tactile book will never go away because it is a singular experience. When you're on your phone or when you're on a tablet, you're still connected. This is a sacred act, sister. This is sacred.
That's right. If you're holding a book in your hands,
that's it.
That's all you can be doing.
That's it.
And that is a spiritual experience.
It is.
And yes, I think you're absolutely right. So get out and read and email Stacy with your book club ideas and comments. Email her at bookclub@wjct.org. This month's pick, The Black Tulip by Alexandre Dumas. Stacy will be appearing January 29th at 6:30 p.m. at San Marco Books and More to talk about another book. And you can also meet her February 12th at noon at The Comer. It's Love Letters, an afternoon with Stacy and Cindy Edelman as they discuss literature. Always good to have you on the show and lots of opportunities to meet you.
That's right.
Coming
Happy New
up.
Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for all the wonderful books that you bring each and every month to this program. In a minute, some music as we speak with flamenco great Otmar Lieber. It's a preview of his performance in Ponte Vedra tomorrow night. And we have a ticket giveaway coming up. That's right. Plus, we'll check in on St. Augustine's Leitner Museum. Don't go away. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Back in a moment.
Lounge is now on Spotify. On the road or at home, take us wherever you go. Just search WJCT 89.9 on Spotify, where the Electro Lounge is always on.
After more than a year and a half of a trade war, there is a deal of sorts set to be signed.
Well, I don't think it's the beginning of the end of the trade war. I think it's a beginning of some stabilization, we hope.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. What the trade war has done to this economy. Next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Carol Hills. In 2014, a revolution seemed to change everything in Ukraine.
The changes that happened, they are really irreversible. It was like a civilizational shift, if you want.
But today, Ukraine is under a lot of pressure. It's at war with Russia. It's also at the center of the U.S. impeachment saga. A Ukrainian politician weighs in on her country's future. Next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, two reporters who shared a Pulitzer Prize last year for their Wall Street Journal reporting on the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. Now those reporters, Joe Palazzolo and Michael Rothfeld, have written a book called The Fixers, the bottom feeders, crooked lawyers, gossip mongers, and porn stars who created the 45th president. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
There are roughly 3 million registered nurses in America, and the country needs more. Nurses now provide care that used to be reserved for doctors. Still, they're not always at the table when the decisions get made. I'm Todd Zwillick, how nurses are changing the face of American medicine. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. That is the beauty of flamenco music. I recently spoke with award-winning songwriter and nouveau flamenco guitarist Otmar Liebert. Liebert will be performing tomorrow night at the Pontevedra Concert Hall with Luna Negra. Here's a preview. It's exciting that you'll be coming and performing at the Pontevedra Concert Hall. Tell us a little bit about the music and the show.
Well, the music has been around for quite a while. And my first album came out exactly 30 years ago. It was called Nuevo Flamenco.
Mm-hmm.
They say it was the biggest selling instrumental guitar album of all time. We will create a mix of them. Obviously, with so many albums, we've got a lot of things to pick from. And every year when we go out, we try to change the set list a little bit, and it usually has some stuff, some old stuff, some stuff from, you know, the past three decades and something new. So that's sort of what we have been doing and then what we do every year.
All right, cool. And let me ask you as well, you mm-hmm. are known for your unique style of flamenco. Tell me a little bit about how you developed that.
I think a lot of it had to do with in 1986, I moved to Santa Fe. And Santa Fe itself is a mix of things. And locally, it's known as you've got the Native American part, you've got the Hispanic part, and then everything else is considered Anglo. It doesn't matter where you come from, but the third element is Anglo. But so the Hispanic part is divided into Mexican and Spanish. And so you have, you know, a lot of people playing flamenco here, but you also have a lot of people playing mariachi music. And so my first album actually combined a lot of those elements from mariachi music and flamenco. And it just proved to be something that people hadn't heard before. And something that took off on its own.
That's Otmar Liebert performing tomorrow night in Pontevedra. Special treat right now. We're giving away a package for his performance. We've got a pair of tickets, one signed CD, and a meet and greet with renowned flamenco guitarist Otmar Liebert after the show. All right, we're going to pick a winner at random. Email us right now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org if you want that package. Finally, this hour, there's a lot happening this winter at St. Augustine's Leitner Museum. Teresa Radzinski is board chair of trustees at the Leitner, and she's on the line. Hey, Teresa.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. So you've been revitalizing the museum, and you also have a new partnership going on with Corazon Cinema and Cafe. Tell us about it.
Yes, we do. So we have the new catchphrase. We are lighting up the Leitner.
Mm-hmm.
So the Florida Humanities Council, we are hosting their speaker series through March in partnership with the Corazon Cinema. Every speaker series is going to have a corresponding film that will be at the Corazon, and all of the details are on our website, and it's going on through March. So we're very excited about that partnership. We also are, today there will be a press release going out. We also were the recipient of a very important work of art from painter George Hitchcock, who is an impressionist painter. We had a donor, Dave Gonzalez, donate this painting over the holiday. It was installed, and it's now up for display on the third floor in our ballroom. So people should, while they're going to the speaker series, check this out. There'll be a press release today that will actually have a photograph of this painting. So we're really excited about that. The museum is also looking for a new executive director to really reinvigorate the space. We believe we have an incredible historic property, and we really would like to reengage both the tourist community as well as local artists and local residents. So we have lots going on, and most specifically this partnership with the Corazon, which is a reason to come to both the museum and the cinema.
The liner is a treasure. It is in the former Alcazar Hotel, built, of course, by Henry Flagler. You have one of the finest collections of fine and decorative 19th century art in America. And if you go to leitnermuseum.org, you can learn more about this upcoming speaker series and learn more about the museum, because this is a way to sort of check it all out at once. As I'm looking through the website, what is the event coming up on the speaker series you want to plug quickly, Teresa, before we let you go? What's the next one?
It's hard to just pick one, Melissa. We would love to plug them all. So I would just have everyone look at the website. There's so much to choose from. And also the Corazon's schedule for January is out. So please come check out the Leitner. We are, quote unquote, lighting up the Leitner.
Again, that's leitnermuseum.org. Teresa Radzinski on the line from St. Augustine. We always love to spotlight events in St. Augustine whenever we can. So, Teresa, thank you so much for being with us, and have fun.
Thank you.
That's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Heather Schatz produces this program. Michelle Quorum is our director. Jessica Palumbo is station news director. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. We always value your feedback. Keep those comments coming to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. And if you missed anything from today's show, just catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll be back tomorrow at 9 a.m. Looking forward to connecting with you then. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.